All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Russell Hsiao. I am the executive director here at the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to public education through policy research. Our mission is to enhance U.S.-Taiwan relations. To achieve our mission, we undertake several major programs that include a weekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief, which is a weekly newsletter that we disseminate through online. That includes articles written by leading as well as emerging experts on Taiwan policy issues. They also include our bi-weekly seminar series, which you are partaking in today. We also have funded fellowship opportunities that will encourage academics and scholars to conduct exchanges both in Taiwan and here in Washington, D.C. To facilitate stronger understanding about U.S.-Taiwan relations. And we also have an annual symposium that we're in the process of planning and for September 14th. The official announcement for that event with the lineup will be coming very shortly, so please stay tuned. If you are not already signed up to receive our updates, please do so on our website. It's at www.globaltaiwan.org so that you can stay up to date with all our programs. I'd like to take this opportunity right now to also acknowledge some of our distinguished guests in the room. First of all, we have our counselor, Dr. David Tsai, and our vice chairperson, Jennifer Hu. She may not be here just yet. Okay, not here yet. Okay, well, my apologies. But nevertheless, you know, the counselors and the board of directors' support for our organization is really what sustains this the mission that we are undertaking here. And so I just want to extend my thanks and appreciation for their continued support. It would be remiss of me also to not acknowledge the hard work and input of our wonderful staff here. We're a small team, but I like to think we punch above our weight here. And they are Melissa Newcomb, Anna Scott Bell, Lily Lin, David Ahn, as well as our interns, Sebra, Matt, and Ned, whose work, like I said earlier, keeps all our programs running. Now, before I hand the floor over to our pride here, Sebra, we'll be moderating today's panel on boosting human capital for U.S.-Taiwan policy. It's my distinct honor to introduce the opening keynote speaker for today's event, the Deputy Representative James Lee from Taiwan's de facto embassy, the Taipei Economic and Cultural Representative of Office. Deputy Representative Lee holds an MBA from the University of Hawaii and a BA in English Literature from Furun Catholic University. He has been serving as a Deputy Representative since June 2015 and previously served as the representative for the Taipei Representative Office in the Netherlands from August 2012 to May 2015. He was named Diplomat of the Year in 2003 and was bestowed the Outstanding Contribution Award by the President of Taiwan in 2003. After Deputy Representative Lee's remark, he will unfortunately not be able to stay with us for too long, but he has mentioned that his staff, who are in the audience today, will be able to answer any questions that you may have regarding to the opportunities that that there is to conduct exchanges and studies in Taiwan. So please do not hesitate to present any questions to them. So Deputy Representative Lee, please.
Thank you very much for having me here, and thank you, Russell, for your kind introduction. To be honest, I did enjoy my post in the Netherlands. The reason is simple. Who can resist the beauty of millions of tulips dancing along with the windmills in the spring, and the tasty herrings with Heineken beer, with powder cheese in the summer, and not to mention the wonderful experience of biking below the sea level. But while walking in the DC, you cannot afford to the luxury of indulging in nostalgia. So let's back to reality and back to today's topic. And I want to first thank the GTI Global Taiwan Institute for putting together this distinguished panel to discuss U.S.-Taiwan public diplomacy. This is a relatively new and fast-expanding field that diplomats and foreign policy elite constantly exercise. And I'm glad to see so many friends here fully occupied. Even I myself cannot have find a seat to sit. So I feel honored to make opening remark. Let's first talk about what public diplomacy is and its importance for Taiwan. There is no single consensus definition of public diplomacy, but we all can agree that it is a key mechanism through which a sovereign state communicate with the public in other countries, aim at informing and influencing the audience, promoting its national interest, and advancing its foreign policy agenda. I think the public diplomacy in recent years has changed significantly. It has been adapted to leverage soft power resources in a more effective manner through the internet, the social media. We have witnessed new and innovative approaches evolving from one-way communication to a more interactive model, and in which the government joined the policy conversation and shaped the message. So I think public diplomacy is especially critical for Taiwan because Taiwan has no formal diplomatic ties with major powers, including the United States, and does not enjoy full membership in most principal international organizations. So under such difficult circumstances, Taiwan has to resort to the public diplomacy and soft power projection as a vital means for elevating its visibility and presenting its value to the international community while bypassing the issues of recognition. Then you might ask, what are Taiwan's soft power advantages and strengths? Now, over the years, Taiwan's soft power has evolved from promoting itself as a strategic value of allies against communism to highlighting its function as a dynamic economic formula fit for emulation. And then more recently, to its roles as a bastion of democratic values. And Taiwan has grown into a society over the past 4 decades that represents most of the important values that the United States try to promote elsewhere in the world. So Taiwan's unique success story with this distinctive combination of modern Western values and traditional Oriental cultures is particularly appealing to mainlanders on the other side of the Taiwan Strait and foreigners all over the world. In less than 4 decades, Taiwan has transformed itself from authoritarian regime to a vibrant democracy. It has moved from poverty to prosperity under continuing military threat from the other side of the strait and with limited natural resources. So in the end, Taiwan has achieved extraordinary economic, political, social, and technological success, largely through its native intelligence, education, and entrepreneurship of its hardworking and peace-loving people. So this remarkable story is Taiwan's best soft power projection. I think the story continued. 2 weeks ago, President Trump and Mr. Terry Kuo, the chairman of a Taiwan-based company, Foxconn, announced to invest $10 billion US dollars investment in Wisconsin to showcase Taiwan's vibrant economic power. And earlier this year, the annual report by Freedom House ranked Taiwan the freest country in Asia with a score of 91, a little bit higher than the US score of 89. Sorry for that. And President George Bush referred to Taiwan as the beacon of democracy in the Pacific. In addition, Taiwan is going to establish the first national museum for human rights in East Asia. So all this highlights Taiwan's status as its lighthouse for freedom, democracy, and human rights. So obviously, Taiwan's strategy in public diplomacy has been to take full advantage of these examples of soft power and those remarkable success stories. So by doing so, Taiwan has attracted audience around the world to pay more attention to it and recognize it as a credible member in the international community. Now let's talk about some of Taiwan's policy tools in public diplomacy, outreach to the United States. Over the decades, mutual understanding and friendship between Taiwan and the United States has been fostered and deepened through people-to-people contacts and various programs, educational and youth exchange programs. On the Taiwan side, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Education provide a variety of scholarships to U.S. citizens seeking Chinese language study or field study and degree program. Russell just reminded me, some of you or your friends, your kids, or your neighbor's kids might be interested in seeking study abroad. So he asked me to highlight those opportunities funded by Taiwan government to American students. And here is the summarized list. I believe every one of you already have a copy of it. If you don't have it, on your way out, a handout will be available. Or you can also go to the websites for further information. For youth exchanges, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs sponsors an annual youth leadership program called Mosaic Taiwan. It is a three-week summer program which targets future American leaders. And another unique opportunity initiative available to young Americans with Taiwanese ancestry is the Taiwan Tech Track program, called the TTT program, which offers 8 weeks summer internship, allowing Taiwanese Americans to learn more about Taiwan's and its high-tech industries. On the U.S. side, various category of scholarship sponsored and supported by the State Department has been launched in Taiwan, including the Fulbright Scholarship, the Fulbright English Teaching Assistant Program, the International Visitor Leadership Programs, the Critical Language Scholarship, and the Bain Gilman's International Scholarship. I believe Lisa and other panelists will share their insights into the U.S. program later on. And this year marks the 60th anniversary of Taiwan Fulbright Scholarship. We very much appreciate the U.S. long-term support for this program. I firmly believe that investing in our next generation leaders to generate more public awareness of the importance of our relationship will lead to an even stronger and more robust U.S.-Taiwan partnership in the long run. So in closing, let me just say that we look forward to working closely with the United States to further strengthen the people-to-people tie by promoting more exchanges and outreach programs. And I wish every one of you great success in today's event. And I look forward to hearing the comments and recommendations from our panel of experts. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Representative, for the opening remarks. We will now segue into our panel of distinguished experts. I would like to ask for our speakers to turn the mics on before we start. So first and foremost, I am extremely grateful for this wonderful opportunity as Cho Yaohui intern to serve as moderator for a panel of distinguished experts. Thank you to Global Taiwan Institute for mentorship to grow as a young Asia policy professional by organizing a public seminar on a topic I am truly passionate about. Before I begin, can I have a show of hands of people who have never been to Taiwan? Okay, so I hope by the end of the seminar, it will inspire you to see what Taiwan has to offer. Now I will briefly introduce the topic at hand before introducing our speakers. So after the U.S. ended official diplomatic relations with Taiwan in 1979, the Taiwan Relations Act, or TRA, continues to be the backbone of unofficial relations between the two countries. TRA stipulates that it is the policy of the United States to preserve and promote extensive, close, and friendly commercial, cultural, and other relations between the people of the U.S. and Taiwan. Educational and cultural exchanges between Taiwan and the U.S. Is a very important part of U.S.-Taiwan relations, as the people-to-people pillar of the bilateral relationship can have long-term positive impact on security cooperation and economic ties. Public diplomacy, as the Deputy Representative noted, is a tool used by governments that taps into soft power resources with the hope to gain favorable responses from the international community. One of the many ways to do this is to build bridges through educational and cultural programming. Today's topic of boosting human capital for U.S.-Taiwan policy is for the D.C. Asia policy community. The aim of this seminar is to encourage more aspiring and current Asia policy professionals to experience Taiwan in its own right. By having personal experiences with Taiwan and its people, it undoubtedly enhances our work on Taiwan here in Washington, allowing us to make better policy decisions that is informed of Taiwan's democracy and shared values with the U.S. At the end of 2016, it was announced that there would be a record high of over 1 million visitors between the two sides. While both countries have visa waiver programs that contribute to tourism on both sides, these types of exchanges are mainly short and business-driven. Long-term exchanges that seek to deepen people-to-people relations must be pursued as well. According to recent statistics provided by the Institute for International Education Open Doors report, there was only 880 American students that studied abroad in Taiwan in 2014-15. This number pales in comparison to the 12,790 American students who went to China that same year. Given Taiwan's like-minded values with U.S. regional partners, the amount of American students going to Taiwan should be around the same as Japan and South Korea, which were 6,053 and 3,520 respectively. Given these facts, Taiwan is missing out from the impressive growth trend of American students studying in East Asia. As a student of Asian studies in the U.S., I see a lack of interest in Taiwan firsthand. While interest in China continues to spread across American campuses, interest in Taiwan remains barely existent. American students do not see the value of traveling to Taiwan, instead viewing Taiwan as nothing more than a subset of China. A vast majority of Chinese language students opt to study simplified characters instead of traditional, deciding early on that their soon-to-be-acquired Chinese skills are not meant to be used in Taiwan. Few Americans can identify Taiwan on a map. Even fewer Americans can identify the factors that make Taiwan unique. Given the importance of P2P in U.S.-Taiwan relations, today's seminar will discuss Taiwan's values and why it matters to the U.S., an outline of U.S. public diplomacy efforts to Taiwan, and educational and cultural programming in place for Americans. The overall goal, as mentioned earlier, is to increase awareness of what Taiwan has to offer. So I will now introduce our esteemed panelists. You have the bios in front of you, so I would just highlight their successes in a succinct manner. So Dr. Robert Sutter has been professor of practice of international affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs, George Washington University, since 2011. He directs the Elliott School of International Affairs program, which includes 1,000 students, and teaches a graduate course on Taiwan's internal developments in foreign policy. He is a PhD graduate from Harvard University and has taught at Georgetown, GW, Johns Hopkins, and UVA. He has published 21 books and hundreds of articles of government dealing with U.S.-Asia relations. His government career spans over 33 years of work, and that includes at CRS, National Intelligence Council, State Department, and Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Next, we have Ms. Lisa Heller. She is the Director of the Office of Public Diplomacy at the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs. Prior to July 2015, she was Minister Counselor for Public Affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. She's a Foreign Service Officer, a career Foreign Service Officer, for over 25 years, and her overseas assignments include Taiwan, South Korea, and Ukraine, in addition to China. She has also worked for the U.S. Information Agency, and she is a native of Pittsburgh, and she studied at Princeton University, University of Minnesota, and UC Berkeley. Finally, we have Mr. Andrew McCullough. He is Assistant Project Director for the Critical Language Scholarship at the American Councils for International Education. He has spent 4 years working on CLS institutes in East Asia, Pacific, and the Middle East. And these include Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, Oman, and Morocco. He graduated from the East Asian Languages and Civilizations program at UChicago and has lived extensively in China and South Korea. So the format of the panel today is three directed questions to our speakers, followed by a Q&A from our audience. So my first question is for Professor Sutter. You have extensive experience in East Asian and Pacific affairs and U.S. foreign policy as both a practitioner and scholar. Moreover, you teach the only graduate seminar on Taiwan's internal and international affairs in D.C. that studies Taiwan in its own right. Could you please start us off by providing insight on Taiwan's soft power and why it matters to the U.S.?
Yes, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here and to talk with you about this issue. I appreciate coming after the discussion on the soft power by the Deputy Representative. That was very helpful in putting in context some of the things that I hope to say here this afternoon. My basic message here is just a reminder that all of this takes place in a broader, all of this development of Taiwan soft power and what it means in U.S.-Taiwan relations takes place in a broader context of American-China policy. Here in Washington, it takes place in that context. And what drives that heavily, of course, is China, as far as Taiwan is concerned, is China's goal. China wants Taiwan. And the U.S. Finds that difficult to deal with. And so this is a tension in American-China relations of long-standing, And it's a triangular type of dynamic that takes place here. And in this dynamic over the years, and I'm going to give sort of historical perspective, you mentioned the Taiwan Relations Act. I was working for Congress during the Taiwan Relations Act time. We've had our ups and downs in U.S.-China relations regarding Taiwan. And so Taiwan's soft power, my argument here, is that it's been important throughout this period, important as an attractive element in American interaction with Taiwan and with and in determining American policy toward China. You see this first firsthand in the Congress. You see it in the debate over the Taiwan Relations Act. You see it repeatedly in the various pieces of legislation that are passed over the last several decades. The general pattern in U.S. policy in those decades, as far as Taiwan is concerned, is to give a very high priority to China, and that the Taiwan issue is handled in a way that will not unduly upset China. So this has been this is the prevailing pattern that you see in American relations that has an impact on Taiwan. And Taiwan's soft power is important in that context as an element that keeps American attention on Taiwan in a positive way, reinforces the determination of the United States to oppose coercive means on the part of China vis-a-vis Taiwan, and other such things. But the fact is that the main thrust is limits the American interaction with Taiwan because of concern about China. Now that isn't always the case, but it is most of the case. It's the case most of the time. In the case of the Taiwan Relations Act, for example, the Congress objected to the Carter administration's approach and made a number of changes, pushed for changes that were basically forced on the Carter administration. And those were carried out. Meanwhile, we've had revisions on the part of the executive branch. From time to time, you see shifts in policy on China that impact Taiwan. And in these instances, too, Taiwan's soft power is an important element as to why the U.S. is doing certain positive things for Taiwan, even if it does somewhat upset Beijing. And this happened in the mid-80s, and it happened in the first couple of years of the George W. Bush administration. But in the current situation, we're coming off a period of probably, since 2002, a period where China is first, that Taiwan is, the Taiwan issue is managed very very carefully in a way that doesn't allow for a big actions that might upset the relationship with China. Taiwan's still important, but people like me look at this and say, well, maybe Taiwan's losing out over the long term. Maybe this is something that isn't really in the broad interest of Taiwan, at least over the long haul. In any event, we went through this period, and it was compounded by the Ma Ying-jeou government, which was determined to manage its relationships with China in a way that would not upset Beijing, reinforcing this sensitivity on not doing things in American relations with Taiwan that could be upsetting to Beijing. But that may be changing. We have a new government in the United States, and this new government is emerging in a period when the broad feeling toward China is hardening on the part of Democrats and Republicans. Just look at all the various study groups that have issued reports about China policy. The Asia Society is the one I would commend to you, full of Democrats arguing for a tougher policy toward China on across the board. Barack Obama, as president, repeatedly criticized China in the last 3 years of from 2014 on in his administration for various infractions, not on Taiwan, but on various infractions. Reflecting a toughening in American attitudes toward China. The question I put that we need to think about is, will this change the American approach to Taiwan? Will the Americans be more forthcoming? On the part of, I'm a registered Democrat, I've always voted Democratic, but on the part of the Republican Party, we find that that they have taken a much more positive view toward Taiwan in their platform of last year, and the elements that you see behind this are designed to do more for Taiwan. There are various opinions. I see three of them. The first is basically treat Taiwan for its own sake. So if you have a positive situation with Taiwan, if you think it's positive, you should be very active in working with Taiwan in this regard, and not so sensitive to your concerns about Beijing. The second group is a group that, as we harden with China, as America hardens its policy toward China, they look for a strategy of how to defend themselves. And Taiwan looms very large in this type of calculus. It's right in the first island chain. It's very important in this regard for these strategies. And the third line is those who feel that if you're going to deal with China effectively, you have to be able to link issues. You have to be able to impose costs. You can't just go down on one path and try to find the answer to an issue on just that one path. And this, and of course, the Chinese link all the time. And so the argument here is that the Americans should do this as well, and Taiwan is seen as part of that type of approach. And so that's not necessarily good for Taiwan, but it is nonetheless emblematic of a changing opinion base here in the United States that raises the possibility of an even more, of a higher, somewhat higher profile for Taiwan as a feature in American policy moving forward. So in all of these elements, the positive element of soft power is very important in maintaining a relationship with Taiwan, and it can be an impetus to increase the relationship with Taiwan, even to the point of perhaps being more controversial with Beijing.
Thank you, Professor Sutter, for bringing us the U.S.-China context to our topic today. So my next question is to Lisa. So Professor Sutter did discuss some policy, but I was wondering if you can provide an overview of U.S. policy towards Taiwan on the public diplomacy front, given the fact that the U.S. and Taiwan have shared values, and for this event, values in the deep appreciation and understanding of good education.
Thank you. First, I want to thank the Global Taiwan Institute for inviting me today. I'll move this back here. And Sebra for working to put together this panel. And I'll just say first how honored I am to be on a panel with Dr. Sutter, whose work I've read and admired for years. And thank you to Andrew, too, because they do great work at American Councils, and I've worked with them in a couple of continents now. To answer the question directly, the U.S. State Department has always valued the people-to-people exchanges in Taiwan, and that has not flagged over the years. And in fact, the number and amount of our exchange programs that we fund in the educational sphere and in the professional sphere is evidence of how much we value this. As Sebra mentioned, Taiwan is definitely a place with which we share a lot of important values in rule of law, market economy, and the appreciation for the importance of an education. So this is something that we definitely want our young people to be exposed to, and we've continued throughout all the years, even in difficult budget climates, to ensure that is a very much a part of the whole exchange picture that we have at the State Department. I don't want to bore you with a lot of facts and figures, but I'll just kind of quickly mention a lot of the programs that we have that kind of give an example of that. First, starting with the very youngest folks, the high school students, we have our National Strategic Language Initiative. Every year, we send a small number of them to study at a high school, live with host families. I think they're in Kaohsiung, right? And they start young, learning. Going a little bit up the age, we have the Critical Language Scholarship Program, which Andrew's organization runs for us, and they send a number of college-age students to Taiwan every year. And then we also have the Benjamin Gilman Fellowships, which provide students who require financial aid to study overseas at the college and graduate school level. And I'll just say, earlier this week, I was at a ceremony for New Zealand, which had endowed a certain number of scholarships at the Gilman Fellowship to send a lot more American students to New Zealand. So if Taiwan's looking for some good places to put a little more extra scholarship money, the Gilmans are open for consultation. And of course, our flagship program with educational exchange in Taiwan and elsewhere around the world is the Fulbright program. Taiwan has one of our most established, and I'll tell you, for someone who's worked in the East Asia region, most respected Fulbright programs in the region. It's been going, I think this is its 60th anniversary this year. About 3,000 scholars have come on the Fulbright program. And it has just again and again paid off in terms of the depth and the understanding that it has built. And the Taiwan program in particular has always been a flagship for the rest of the region. I should mention, too, when we talked about students coming to the United States, Taiwan sends a very robust number of Americans of students to American universities every year. I think for its population size, it's the most per capita of any place around the world. It's about 20,000, is that correct? Yes, 20,000. And if you look at the size of the population there, that's truly extraordinary. And last, I'm going to directly address Sephora's comment about the number of American students who study in Taiwan, because this is something I actually did a little research on. Until this past summer, I was the public affairs officer in Beijing, China. And, you know, we're very interested in the number of American students studying there. And we actually were wondering why the last several years the number of American students have declined in China. So, there were 12,000, but that's down from 14,000, 15,000 a couple of years before. And so we were looking at the data, and where are these students, why are they not coming and where are they going? And the answer we found is that by and large they're still going overseas, but they're not going to China as much anymore. They're spreading out. So it's true that there were only 880 the last time in Taiwan, but that represents a 10% increase of the year before when there were only 800. So students are not just going to the mainland. Taiwan's one of the places. Now, there's some other countries in the region that they're also going to, Thailand and a few others. Burma is suddenly hot. But there definitely is a trend towards to a lot of these places. More of them are discovering Taiwan. So more American students are going there. They're recognizing the value of Taiwan, and we encourage that. We think that's wonderful, and we're looking for more that we can do. But we just want to say that we think that's a great trend, and we hope it does continue.
Thank you, Lisa, for highlighting the educational exchange programs funded by State Department. You can find it in the packet if you're interested in applying. And thank you, Lisa, for addressing that question in regards to American students going to Taiwan and China. So now I move to Andrew. So Lisa provided an excellent summary of the programming in place. And given the fact that American Councils administer State Department's public diplomacy programs, could you please talk about what your organization has done to increase programming in Taiwan? I believe there was an MOU signed between your organization and Taiwan's Ministry of Education.
Thank you, Sephora. I really appreciate that. Oh, there we go. Okay. Thank you, Sephora. I really appreciate the introduction earlier, and I want to thank Mr. Xiao and the GTI for including us, American Councils, in this panel. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be serving on the panel with Dr. Sutter and Ms. Heller, who have so much more experience than myself working with Taiwan. But I hope that our organization, American Councils, can provide some perspective on the implementation of programs in country and our work to broaden the collaboration with Taiwan of American international education community and organizations. I'd also like to thank Deputy Representative Lee for his remarks. I think what he speaks about in terms of public diplomacy from Taiwan in the United States has a lot to bear on our view of education programming. And we hope through our programs also to be able to achieve some of those goals as well. So first, I want to take a moment just to outline some of the activities that American Councils for International Education has embarked on with regards to our Taiwan programming and the programs that we run there. First of all, I work on the Critical Language Scholarship Program that Ms. Heller introduced just now. It's a program that's a program of the U.S. Department of State, fully funded for American undergraduate and graduate students to go overseas for the course of 8 weeks over a summer to learn intensively one of 14 different languages that are considered critical by the U.S. government. We seek a broad range of representation of people from different majors and different parts of the country and different experiences, because it recognizes on some level the importance of learning languages like Chinese to America's future national security interests, national competitiveness, and economic prosperity in the United States as the world becomes more globalized, and the importance of communication with other players and other countries is highlighted and heightened. In addition to the Critical Language Scholarship Program, which we administer, which sends this year 24 students to Taiwan to study at the National Cheng Kung University in Tainan, we also have been collaborating over the past 2 years with TECRO and the Ministries of Education and Foreign Affairs at in Taiwan to administer a couple of different education programs for American students. First, we work on a program known as the Taiwan Intensive Summer Language Program. That program is administered by American councils in collaboration with TECRO at National Cheng Kung University. And it sends, in its first inaugural year, 2016, it sent 8 students to study Chinese language and culture. And then this past year, we expanded to 29 students. And like unlike the CLS program, it does not receive full funding from the U.S. Department of State and the U.S. government. However, I think one of the similarities in an area where American Councils has been able to collaborate with TECRO and the Ministries of Education and Foreign Affairs is that there's a strong interest in making sure that these programs are not simply available to students who have a significant financial resources to put towards study abroad. It's very important to us, American Councils, which is a nonprofit, as well as, I think, recognized by Deputy Representative Lee in his remarks, and our collaborators and partners at National Cheng Kung University, that access to these programs, not just at the high level where students are doing Asian studies, but also across a broad swath of the United States, where we draw students from for this program 22 different universities and a variety of different majors, including STEM majors, which are science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields, in the arts, in medical research, and in a variety of different areas of the economy, that is going to be very important to achieving the goals of people-to-people diplomacy, both in-country as an introduction of the United States values and our history and culture in Taiwan, and then also after the program ends, bringing back the experience of meeting Taiwanese people and working in Taiwan and learning Chinese language in Taiwan in an immersive environment, bringing that experience back to the United States, to their campuses, and that can have a large impact, I think, on the communities that students are coming from. So in that sense, we have a shared mission with our education program, shared with MOFA and MOE, make these opportunities available to students. And so for this past year, our program, the Intensive Summer Language Program, although students did not receive a full funding to go, nevertheless, on average, our students who participate in this program received $4,000 in scholarship aid from the Ministry of Education, as well as other grants from through programs administered by the U.S. government, such as FLAST, or through other foundations, such as the Freeman Foundation, the Blake Moore Foundation, or the Fund for Education Abroad. So we're very proud to be working on that alongside the Ministries of Education and Foreign Affairs in Taiwan. In addition to that, we have worked on a program, a short-term cultural program. In 2016, we sent 5 students on a program that focused not on language education specifically, but rather on cultural, on studying the culture, the history, and the politics of Taiwan. And one of the driving forces behind this programming is a recognition that for many students in the United States, certainly not Georgetown, but for students at other institutions that we partner with, there is still a lack of access to information about Chinese language, Chinese studies, and then Taiwan specifically, there's a lot of, lack of access to information about Taiwan as a country. And so we see this and as an opportunity to help students become acclimated to the environment, and to learn a little bit about the country of Taiwan and begin their journey down, for us, what is a linguistic journey towards fluency, cultural and linguistic fluency, and in an easy and accessible way. We also work with a lot of students for whom a full summer program is a luxury. For students at community colleges or at minority-serving institutions in the United States, it's very important to be able to meet them halfway with a program where they're able to participate without necessarily giving up some of the opportunity costs of staying in the United States and working and putting together credits for their graduation. For that reason, we also look forward to next year to expanding the program to 4 weeks. But in addition to that, adding an element of university credit so that students who participate in a program learning about the culture and environment of Taiwan will be able to come back and apply that experience to their degree. This is something that the Critical Language Scholarship already does and that students can do through the Intensive Summer Language Program administered by American Councils. But we see this as a way to reach a new audience and a different audience for the future of Taiwan and U.S. relations and mutual understanding between the two countries.
Thank you, Andrew, for talking about American Councils and partnering in Taiwan in new programming. So my next question goes to Professor Sutter. To continue this discussion on the importance of Taiwan, in your publication with NBR, you co-authored a report on Taiwan's national power. Would you mind sharing with us your views on Taiwan's strengths? More specifically, can you address Taiwan's base of wealth, talent, innovative potential, and why it's important to U.S. regional interests?
thanks very much, Sebra. Before I do, I just want to say something about American strengths. It seems to me that American civil society is very active and that public-private partnerships are a big part of this. And I think that's a feature of the United States. So when we think about the United States as, in Asia and the world, but in Asia is the area that I focus on, many people say, oh, the U.S. is in decline and this type of thing. And this is an element that doesn't get nearly as much attention as it should. This dynamic of between the government and the private sector dealing with constructive relationships in the region, and so and American, in particular, American non-governmental efforts in the region. So, but anyway, on getting back to the point here of strengths, Taiwan's strengths. This study was done by the National Bureau for the National Bureau of Asian Research. I co-authored with my David Gitter, and it's it dealt with a whole series of basic strengths in Taiwan, and there are so many. The advanced economy, a high standard of public welfare, the open society. Taiwan is such an open society. It's welcoming. Strangers are welcomed in Taiwan. It's tolerant and it's caring. These institutions that Taiwan has in civil society, and the government backs this too, are very caring about not only themselves, they're caring about other people. And they do this throughout the world in a variety of ways. Of course, the new democracy in Taiwan gets an awful lot of attention. And this is a democracy, it has its rough spots, but it accepts leadership change. And this has just gone on repeatedly. So it's a very strong sort of situation that Taiwan faces. It has a capable military, it has many strengths, but it has a big problem. And the study identifies this problem, and it's called the PRC. It's an amazing problem. And so this is lovely, what's going on in Taiwan, but if you don't take account of the PRC, you're dealing with an imaginary world. And so China intimidates, China dominates, China uses positive and negative levers to influence Taiwan, but there's an overall military threat. And this is remarkable that this goes on. We all understand why. And the reasons for it have been accentuated by the Xi Jinping's emphasis on the China Dream. The China Dream means to unify China. That's pretty clear. And so this is a big problem. Now Taiwan can deal with this effectively with its own strengths, but it needs help. And this is where the U.S. comes in. And the U.S. is a big help. The U.S. military is very active in preparing to defend Taiwan if they are attacked by China. And the U.S. provides military support for Taiwan in the form of arms and other types of things. And Taiwan is an island. And so it's really hard to invade this place. And if the PRC tries and fails, it would be very disastrous for the leadership in China. So the sense is they won't try. They'll try other means to deal with this. It'll be sort of coercive, intimidating, and eventually Taiwan will fall like a piece of fruit into Beijing's lap, is the idea. Whether that takes place or not, is certainly in the future, and my sense is it's probably unlikely. But nonetheless, this is what the situation they face. And what do they need? There are weaknesses in Taiwan. They need cohesion. Taiwan doesn't have cohesion. So this is an aspect of democracy that hasn't been dealt with all that well. You have this big pan-blue, pan-green division in Taiwan. And what this means is that domestic strengthening doesn't take place nearly as effectively as it should. They need a cohesive approach in dealing with the economic issues. They need this in dealing with the difficult welfare issues and in dealing with national defense. In all of these areas, they need a more unified approach, which is very difficult because of this acute partisan divide. One of the strengths of Taiwan, which I've long admired, is that they've gone through this transition from a very very strict authoritarian government to a democracy. And that authoritarian government did all sorts of things to the people of Taiwan who later become influential. The oppositionists in Taiwan now, the DPP, they take power. And it didn't lead to a lot of score settling. It didn't lead to violence. People didn't get killed. Transition. You look at other societies, it doesn't happen this way. If you look at memory in East Asia, you find this bitter memory on the part of various people in dealing with issues. There's plenty of bitterness in Taiwan over what happened in the authoritarian period, the white terror of the KMT. But more or less, Taiwan, I think, has done a good job in dealing with this. And at minimum, they haven't killed a lot of people. There hasn't been a lot of score settling. And that's a plus. If you look around the world, that's a big plus. And so the upshot here is that, but Taiwan does need, but this is the root of the disunity. And this has to be resolved in some way so that Taiwan can deal with the situations more effectively that they face in dealing with China. And this would facilitate their relationship with the United States. This would strengthen their approach to the United States. Just one final point. The emphasis in the Deputy Representative's remarks was that the Taiwan people carried out this reform. That's true, no question about it. But the older people in the United States that watch this issue, it's the 60th anniversary of the Fulbright Program, 60th anniversary, okay? It's been going on a long time. Americans have been doing this for a long time. American foreign aid doesn't get a good publicity very often. Taiwan is a big success story for American foreign assistance. It's been going on for a long time, and Taiwan moved very effectively, and the U.S. helped it in a lot of ways in moving in this direction. So if you want some success, you want to pat yourself on the back as an American, Taiwan is one of those places. There aren't too many, but it's one of those places you can say, we did a good job there. And that's another state, the United States, that old-timers have. I'm not sure that this is something that people of the current generation feel, but it's something that's very important, I think, in understanding American support for Taiwan.
Thanks, Professor Sutter, for offering your perspective on Taiwan's national power and ways in which it can improve. So I know you also talked about China factors. So Lisa, given State Department's perspective and priority on developing its relationship with China for strategic and economic reasons, American students seeking to work in foreign policy as a result don't really see the importance of studying in Taiwan. And what ways do you think, under the current policy framework, can the State Department help facilitate more American students to study abroad in Taiwan and create a stronger alumni network for U.S.-Taiwan relations.
All right. Well, as we just said last round, of course, we'll have to put out the idea that there's not a lot of Chinese or American students interested in studying in Taiwan. But there's actually, I think, a growing trend in that direction, and that's very positive. And the number one thing that can help that is exactly what Taiwan is already doing, which is offering very generous scholarships. As the deputy representative pointed out, there's a wide range of things that they're offering, and that is a great enticement, and it's excellent that they're doing that. We at the State Department have been looking globally at the issue of what we can do to get more Americans to study abroad. We realize that there is a huge gap there, that just American young people are not going overseas and learning foreign languages at the rate we would like. So that a couple of years ago, the Department actually created a new office to look at ways to sort of encourage that trend on a global basis. And that particular office has been working with, among other things, the Taiwan Fulbright organization. They studied, they sponsored a conference there last year, looking at ways to make studying in Taiwan more attractive to more young people. We're also looking at ways to increase the alumni. As we noted before, there are a lot of Taiwan students who have studied in the United States, and there are more and more American students who have studied in Taiwan. And the very best way to get future generations to engage in study abroad is usually to have what they learn from their peers and their friends and their friends and their older relatives who've gone overseas. That the person-to-person recommendations is usually what drives a lot of study abroad decisions. And so getting those alumni networks activated is really kind of the key to this. And so we have been working with AIT and has done a number of alumni programs, looking at people who have participated in our various exchange programs from both sides and how they can get more active and encouraging the people they deal with. If they're teachers, for example, bringing their students in business to their younger members and getting them to study abroad. And this is something that we focus on a lot. But this is also something everybody here can do. I mean, by the fact that you're here today, it shows that you are interested in U.S.-Taiwan opportunities, and you know you are here, so you've already demonstrated this interest. And it's really kind of the citizen diplomats that can really kind of get this message out. So it's not just something that we, the State Department, can do. I think it's something that everybody can do, because I think it's something, there are wonderful opportunities in Taiwan, as we know, and I think we want to encourage as many people as possible to take advantage of them.
Thank you, Lisa. I really like the term citizen diplomacy. So my question is for Andrew. As an organization that works on international education and exchange, could you tell us the biggest challenge you see in marketing Taiwan programs? I know this was talked about earlier, but in marketing these programs to the American audience, given your work with students that focus on East Asia, what are factors do you think make a country attractive to study in for Americans?
Thank you, Sebra. I would say, first of all, to focus on some of the challenges for American students. Again, I want to go back and say the PRC is not the only PR issue that Taiwan is dealing with, in the sense that I just think that there's a lot of people on campuses who haven't had the opportunity and are not being driven by their language teachers or by their advisors to study Chinese in Taiwan. There are a lot of students, obviously, who return and have really excellent experiences, and getting those experiences out, as Ms. Heller highlights, in terms of working with alumni of programs in Taiwan to sort of communicate some of the really great aspects of Taiwan as a study destination is going to be key to addressing that. In addition, I would say for students who have some experience with the Chinese language, there is an anxiety among students on campuses and teachers when it comes to the script that's used in Taiwan. In Taiwan, for those who don't know, they use traditional characters, which are slightly more complicated. Ooh, I'm sorry. they're slightly more complicated than the simplified characters that have been used in mainland China for some time now. And there is a sort of sense, I would say, in language classes, that students need to decide early whether to start studying one set of characters or the other, and then a push on the part of some Chinese teachers towards going with simplified, because that sort of hits the biggest the biggest range of individuals who speak Mandarin Chinese. Our experience running intensive language programs in Taiwan is that the difficulty of switching from one character set to the other is a complete myth, in the sense of a student's ability both to pick up on characters, and anyone who's studied Chinese can sort of attest to the fact that you're not there's room in your head to do both, and to learn one and then apply it to the other, and then also that it doesn't have an impact on students' language gains or the outcomes of classes in terms of their fluency in Chinese and Mandarin Chinese, and the use of Putonghua, or the sort of general dialect of Chinese. So that's one thing that I think group programs that like CLS and other programs offered through the Department of State, we spend a lot of time working with scholarship offices, language associations, and teachers to try and communicate and prepare students for that fact, and sort of readjust the thoughts about what it is to learn Chinese in Taiwan generally. That's a challenge for us, and one that we are trying to tackle now. In terms of what makes Taiwan an appealing study abroad location or a location to learn Chinese, first of all, I want to start out by saying we administer a lot of programs in mainland China, and they're excellent. And students can build on their Chinese fluency and proficiency there, and we're very happy with all of the partners that we work with there. However, I do think that there are a couple of things that set Taiwan apart. One, Dr. Sutter brought up in his remarks, which is that Taiwan's civil society is very welcoming and caring. There is for students who are going abroad, maybe for the first time, to study a language intensively, there are a lot of pressures in terms of being away from home, living with a foreign family, being in a different city where people don't speak English and where they're forced to speak Chinese by their evil program administrators. And that can make it difficult, that can make an environment difficult as the learning and educational environment. We seek 100% immersion in our programs because we see that immersion has a strong influence on people's ability to gain proficiency. However, as my colleague Vodka here likes to say, even tourism is a rich cultural and linguistic immersion, but without the structures of education and sort of some of the more environmental factors, it does not necessarily make you a Chinese expert to be a tourist in Taiwan or in China. And so we find that our programs in Taiwan and in Tainan especially benefit from both the open nature of society in Taiwan, the willingness of people to host students in their homes and in their social groups is a great benefit to our students. The fact that the city of Tainan is less complicated and difficult to navigate than Beijing, and the last time I was in Beijing was 2006. I understand that it's only become more difficult and complicated since then. And then you can't overestimate, I would say, the importance of factors like access to Google, the ability to use the tools that our students are familiar with. And then, in addition, as a program administrator, I can tell you that health, more than anything else, can really have an impact on students' ability to A, participate in a program, and then participate successfully through the end of the program. And we deal with a lot of health-related early returns from programs that we administer. And so I can't stress enough that Taiwan, being a relatively cleaner and less polluted environment than the cities of Beijing or Shanghai, has a big impact on our students' ability to participate successfully in that program. And more as time goes on, as international educators, we deal with chronic respiratory conditions of students. That just seems to be a fact of modern life, both here in the United States and abroad. And so as just an environment, sort of concern, Taiwan offers a very appealing destination for students to study Chinese.
Thank you, Andrew, for highlighting that. So my final set of questions for Professor Sutter. is as students of Asian studies, and we have students here today who are going to be rising leaders in Asia policy, taking up positions that will impact U.S. policy in the region, what do you think Taiwan can ultimately offer to U.S. foreign and defense policy? And why would less U.S. support for Taiwan be counterproductive to American interests?
Well, I think the U.S. has a big problem that Taiwan helps a lot in. And the problem is that people in Taiwan, people in China, tend to be friendly toward the United States, in my experience. But the government is much more mixed. And they pose a lot of challenges, and these have risen, as I tried to introduce in my earlier remarks. And with President Obama complaining about them vociferously, and these big differences that we have. And this basic China dream business is something that really isn't in the interest of the United States. I mean, this is if it's done coercively. In practice, if you look at 20 years of China's experience vis-a-vis Taiwan, this is called coercion. And they've been doing this in the South China Sea more recently. It got more attention. The U.S. government doesn't talk about this coercion in the Taiwan case. They talk about the South China Sea and the East China Sea all the time, but not Taiwan. You know, that's part of being sensitive to the PRC, I assume. But it's a reality. And so this is not in the interest of the United States. And so how do you deal with this? Well, you deal with it in a variety of ways. You build up your own strength by doing that. We try to negotiate with Beijing on a variety of issues. And we have a lot of common ground with Beijing. But this China dream and the goal of regional dominance seems to be very important for China. And the countries in the region aren't going to just do this voluntarily, they're going to have to be coerced. And this pattern is not something I like seeing, and so therefore we should be prepared to shape this, to resist it in various ways, to offset it. And in doing that, we're much better off, Americans are much better off if Taiwan's on our side. If Taiwan isn't on our side, then we're in a weaker position to do this. And so Taiwan's position is very important. And the support it provides for the United States, this isn't containment, it's deterring. Deterring this kind of behavior, which I think would lead to a coercive model of dominance, which is not in the interest of the United States, or I would submit in the world order. And so we have to do something about this, and we are, and Taiwan on our side helps. And the key element that it has here is location. Its location is critically important. And so that's how I see it.
Thank you. Taiwan does offer a lot of geostrategic value to the U.S. And my next question is for Lisa. So aside from educational exchanges between U.S. and Taiwan, can you share with us what the State Department has done to strengthen P2P through professional exchanges, like the International Visitor Leadership Program?
Sure. The professional exchanges are the counterpart to all of our academic exchanges, and we do have a number of professional exchanges as well, recognizing that the people who are in the working world are an incredibly valuable part of the people-to-people relationship as well. The International Visitor Leadership Program is our flagship program. Over the years, several thousand future leaders from countries all over the world have traveled to the United States, and Taiwan has always had a very robust participation in this program. We have a couple groups coming this month, one of indigenous Taiwan leaders and another of some legislators, and they're coming to Washington and other cities. The program gives you an opportunity to visit several cities and have professional appointments as well as a chance to spend some time in sort of home hospitality with average Americans. I know at least two former presidents, President Chen and President Ma, have both been participants, as well as many prime ministers and others as well. And this is just one example of the professional exchanges we have. I should say, all together, we at the State Department do administer all of the U.S. Foreign exchange visitor programs, and there's a special visa category, the J-1 visa, for people coming under that category. And from what I can see, the statistics is about 4,000 people from Taiwan coming under that category every year. There's lots of different types of exchange visitors, but that's certainly a pretty hefty number considering the size of the Taiwan population, so that's probably on a per capita basis one of the highest in the world. We have a number of other professional exchange programs. We have some that everything from sports exchanges to culture programs, artists, educators, and others, and across the board. This is an important, as I said, part of our whole exchange relationship with Taiwan. They're all supported by our Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and it's something that we have continued, and we see will probably be continuing very strong. There's been sometimes there's been kind of speculation if the United States is still in the business, and from what I can tell, we still will be doing these exchanges for quite some time because we recognize the value of bringing people together through those very important means.
Thank you, Lisa. And finally, Andrew, my final question for you is, what future programming does the American Council have in regards to Taiwan?
Thank you, Sebra, for the opportunity to shamelessly plug our programs for next year. I'll try to keep it brief. Again, you know, as I mentioned, we're running a couple of different programs with Taiwan. We hope in 2018 to extend our partnership in Taiwan on the Critical Language Scholarship Program. And then also with our American Council's administered programs to expand the short-term study program to a four-week program and extend academic credit to students who are participating on it. And then also to continue to administer the intensive language program that American Council is running in Taiwan. I would say I would like to sort of thank you, first of all, for bringing up the topic of professional exchanges. American Councils, over the past 5 years or so, has made a central part of our international programming internships with local companies in the different countries that we work in. And so we run pretty extensive internship programs in Eurasia and in Central Asia. In the future, I think we see, particularly with regards to STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, majors, and we see an opportunity and interest in extending our internship programs to Taiwan, and so we hope to be able to work with partners on the ground there. And then I also want to say just that there are a lot of opportunities, given the amount of interest that we have from students who are interested in studying Chinese. I misspoke earlier and said we got applications from 22 different universities for our intensive program in Taiwan. The reality is we had 26. So I underspoke a little bit. But in addition to that, if you look at a program like the Critical Language Scholarship Program, we receive over 650 applications for a limited number of spots for programs in intensive Chinese language. And those applications are coming from an incredibly wide range of institutions. We have 273 different institutions in the United States represented in the application groups for intermediate and advanced Chinese. And so this doesn't even include those students who may have an interest in learning Chinese or who have taken 1 year of Chinese. This is over 650 students from 270 plus institutions who are already on the road towards fluency and proficiency, but are not being selected for our program, and so they have to go somewhere else. So there's a great deal of demand for programs to meet this there's a demand for programs to meet this need in the United States. And just to underscore it, that includes a lot of institutions that are termed minority-serving institutions with high percentage enrollments by ethnic and racial minorities in the United States, as well as community colleges and universities that are identified as historically black colleges and universities in the U.S. as well. And so I think that there's a lot of potential for future programming in Taiwan, and we hope to be right there.
That's very exciting. And so last question is for all of our panelists, starting from Lisa and working over to Andrew. If you can quickly share with us some concluding thoughts about your work with Taiwan and what you enjoy the most.
I was very fortunate slightly more than 20 years ago to study at the State Department's Language Institute in Taiwan, and that's where most of our diplomats used to and still get their Chinese instruction. I spent a year there on Yangmingshan, and I also had some time to sort of circumnavigate the island in a rental car. And I'll say, you know, it's the incredible opportunity, and it's also provided extraordinary continuity If you go to that language school, there are photos of the previous classes going all the way back into the 1950s, and pretty much everybody who's anybody at the Department of State who ever learned Chinese, going back to some of the legendary ex-ambassadors and things, all studied there, and their photos are there. So it's part of an extraordinary experience we all share. And most of us have come out of there with great memories, whether they were cultural, food, language, or just the experience of being in such a vibrant place and seeing the very extraordinary changes of Taiwan over the years. So I'm very pleased that I had that opportunity, and I know that it's something that the future diplomats will be looking forward to as well.
Thank you, Lisa. Professor Sutter.
I'm sort of a workaholic, and so I never really got a chance to spend a long time anyplace except at work. And so, but I worked for the Congress for a long time, and the thing that I want to share with you is just the attractiveness of the change in Taiwan. First, working on at CRS, and then I worked on the Foreign Relations Committee for a while. Working on the Taiwan issue, if you will. There were various things people looked at, but they looked at human rights in Taiwan. It's a very sensitive time, watching the development of democracy in Taiwan. So on one congressional visit and my first visit to Taiwan in the late 70s, I remember watching a demonstration in Taipei, in front of City Hall. 100 demonstrators surrounded by cordons of police. There must have been like 4,000 police around these 100 demonstrators. That was the Taiwan of those days. And then, of course, we remember the Kaohsiung incident and the arrest of all the leading opposition leaders, the torturing and so forth that went on in that period. And all these people were under arrest. And I remember I was with a colleague, Ed Freeman, a professor at Wisconsin, but he was an aide to Stephen Solarz at that time. And we were with a delegation at a Taiwan election. I guess it was 1998, an island-wide election. And we went to Kaohsiung, and there were all these people that had been in jail in Taiwan, some of them tortured, some of their relatives were killed. And there they all were on the stage saying whatever the heck they wanted to say. And they were saying the damnedest things. But the bottom line is, they could just do it. And I said to Ed, isn't this something? You know, look at this change, amazing change. So that really captured me, that's for sure.
Thank you, Professor Sutter. Andrew?
I'll say that I think one of the most rewarding things about working with a partnership in Taiwan is that even for less commonly taught languages like Chinese or Arabic or Persian, there is a sort of centralization that takes place in the sense that students who are studying Chinese have a lot of opportunities to go study Chinese in Shanghai or study Chinese in Beijing. And for many people who graduate from an undergraduate program in Chinese studies, their whole experience of the Chinese-speaking world will be what is actually a rather narrow sliver of the east coast of mainland China. For the students who are participating in an exchange program in Taiwan, I think it gives them a real advantage and a different experience that isn't necessarily as ubiquitous or as available to them as students. And so we, I think, when we see our students come back from these programs, we can be comforted in the knowledge that they're bringing back a special kind of expertise and experience to apply to their future careers, and that's a really exciting aspect for me, just to know that they've got a leg up a little bit, not on the Foreign Service, unfortunately, but nevertheless.
Thank you, Andrew. So we do have 10 minutes left for questions from the audience. So please identify yourself and affiliation.
Right here. Hi, my name is Ben Lawson.
And for the microphone, sorry.
Ben Lawson, U.S. Navy. This is for Mr. McAuliffe. With the rise of machine translation and the democratization of intercultural knowledge, how do you see the role of these cross-cultural specialists evolving?
Oh gosh, I'm sure that the two other panelists will have a better answer for that than I. I myself have done literary translation in the past, and so I would argue strongly for the value of human translation over machine translation, although we've seen what I thought would never happen is Google Translate's gotten really good at translating Japanese and Korean, unfortunately, for me. And so there's certainly, you know, you don't want to bet against that horse necessarily. However, I think that there's still, you know, in the ways that cultural knowledge and linguistic knowledge are linked and intertwined, you can't get away from the fact that even if you know what someone's saying, the level of interpretation that goes into understanding an exchange is still of great value. And so I'll leave it at that, and I don't know if anyone else would like to comment on that question, but we believe strongly, and maybe history will leave us in the dust, but we believe strongly in the value of those skills.
Thank you. Do we have another question? Oh, Iris. Thanks, Ned.
Iris Shaw of Taiwan DPP Mission. Thank you all for a very enlightening presentation. Since Andrew touched on the access of tool question, I am really curious, how do you envision the public diplomacy, the U.S. public diplomacy in the age of social media? I know during the Obama administration, there are a lot of State Department talking points about how to use the social medias as a powerful tools for empowerment and promoting democracies and other U.S. values across the world. And this, with this administration, President set the example of tweeting, using Twitter. So I know AIT, definitely everybody noticed the AIT in Taiwan has stellar Facebook presentation, very interactive. Just want to learn about your take on the opportunities as well as the threat, because right now I think a lot of cyber threat actors are taking advantage of the open society and spreading the disinformation is so much easier through the vibrant social media. So also like to know if there is any policy prescription to that.
Check that one. Well, certainly social media is here to stay as part of our public diplomacy. That's not going to change, and we're not going to diminish it, and it's only going to grow. And we're still finding new ways to use it. Just this week, we have some folks at my office who are working on how they can do these sort of crowdsourcing, crowdtangle things to sort of learn about news as it's happening. And so someone in our office who's working on that actually learned about the Sichuan earthquake before our operations center did. And so they're always kind of working on that sort of thing. They're also working on some how to deal with some of the negative challenges that are coming up. Just last night they had a teleconference on how to deal with trolls and things. So it's still an important part of our outreach. I would say another thing we're trying was working on various ways of sort of pre-programming social media to deal with crises as they happen. If there's a flood or a earthquake or a plane crash or anything like that, and how we can kind of better use social media to kind of do better at reaching out and getting people. We've also been doing a lot of work on that just in the last couple of weeks or so. So there's kind of, it's presenting a lot of new opportunities, but you're right, it does present a lot of negative things too, and how we balance kind of dealing with some of the negativity without cutting off people's free speech and right to express themselves is certainly part of it. We're doing a lot of work all over, including in Taiwan, but all over Asia with media literacy and helping people get smart about evaluating what it is they see on the internet and what it is they see on social media because it's they're sort of more and more coming at people and people need to be really smart consumers and helping people evaluate what they see. And then also we're doing a lot with civil society and helping emerging civil society organizations throughout Asia get smart on how they use social media and how people do a lot of training, tech camps to help them really take advantage of all that has to offer for them.
We can take two more questions here and here.
Hello? Okay, Chia Ching from United Daily News. I have two questions for Lisa. The first question is, you mentioned that the number of American students in China declined. You've mentioned the number, but I'm just wondering if you figure the reason. And the second question is that we've seen documents from the Chinese I think college or school that tried to persuade students not to study in Taiwan. Just want to know if you have concern with the situation and if you would urge the Chinese government or the school or institutes not to do this to the students. Thank you.
The first question is something we researched. We don't have any definitive answer. There's a lot of things that have been suggested as plausible. Everything from just people trying to do something new with new opportunities out there to, as Andrew mentioned, air pollution, internet, lots of possibilities too. And then we've also found that in general, where people go every year is also very highly dependent on like currency exchange rates too, as you can imagine. Costs influence people a lot as well. So that's one thing. I'm not familiar with this particular thing you said of the mainland. Clearly students aren't listening if the number of students in Taiwan was actually increasing. So clearly people are taking advantage of that. We would obviously never want to have anybody discourage anybody from going anywhere, except maybe North Korea. But as a general policy, we want as many people to take advantage of educational opportunities everywhere, and we would certainly never want any country to try to hinder that. But clearly people are smart consumers. They're going to go where it's economically and culturally favorable to them. And I think that American students are, and they will continue to seek out those opportunities.
Final question from this gentleman right here.
Hi, I'm Paul. I'm an intern at the National Bureau of Asian Research. And my question is about utilizing your language skills after these exchange programs. So I study Mandarin in both mainland China through CET and in Taiwan through ICLP. And anyone who studied a foreign language, especially Chinese, knows how quickly you can lose it after you come back, how your second tones become third tones, how they become fourth tones. So while State Department or professionals, they can use Mandarin skills immediately after they come back in the workplace, I find that a lot of students have trouble finding ways to use their language skills, and they go away so quickly. So what is your hope for these students after they come back from these summer programs and feel like it's such a short-term investment?
Would some of my friends from academia or NGO community go with that one?
Well, sure. I think it. I'll just share my experience on this. When I was at the Library of Congress, I was constantly, people would come in looking for work in one way or another. The library's a very open place. And so I would talk with people all the time. And this was a long time ago now, but they thought that with Chinese language, they would get a job. And I think I think you all know that's not going to work. The class is, so you know Chinese. What else do you know? And so you need something else. And so you need both. This something else is something, I think most people know this now. We've gone through a whole series of harder times. And this point about diversifying, I fully agree with this. I mean, I wonder if all these, we're training all these people, I wonder if the opportunities are there for them. Where do they work? Because I see the difficulty my own students have in like, good university in getting employment. So this is it's much, much more competitive than it used to be. And so but the point is that the language is very important, but you need to be a lawyer or a business, an accountant. You need some other skill to get an analyst. You need some other skill in order to get a job. I would definitely suggest people to make sure they have that other part.
I'll just add on to that. We have a lot of students go on our program and come back with that very question. Okay, you taught me Indonesian, now what do I do with it? And I'll say that, as Dr. Sutter highlighted, the important thing for that student in the short term, especially if they're an undergraduate student who's just entering the job market, is that they recognize that those opportunities don't necessarily exist yet. One of the things is it's sort of a chicken or the egg problem, that the people who are hiring for positions or the people who are making business decisions about where to invest money or who to partner with do not necessarily have the knowledge that that student is coming with. And so in the long-term sense, we hope that these investments are not only preparing people for jobs that currently exist, but also preparing people to make decisions and pursue opportunities with that would otherwise not necessarily be open to the business or the field and industry that they're entering. So I always tell them, you know, get a job, you know, get paid. And the important part of our programming, I think, on that regard, is to try as much as possible in our programming to integrate students into the local community and build strong people-to-people relationships with host families, partners, or you know, peer language partners in the university, different interest groups while they're overseas, because it's that long-term interest in language and dedication to learning more about a country and learning more about the people of another place that is going to be the impetus, not a salary figure, for students to continue maintaining their engagement with the language.
All right, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for attending. Thank you so much for the panelists for coming to Boosting Human Capital. And please be citizen diplomats. We do have packets of programs available at the front. So thank you so much.